This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome again to Recovery Radio. My name's Steve Martoreno. We're here on Saturdays, and we're here to talk about the disease of addiction, which is much, much in the news. But we're here most particularly to talk about something that is often not in the news, and that is that people can get help. Millions can manage this disease. They just need more information, and that's what we're dedicated to on Recovery Radio. Sponsored by Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, about which more a little bit later. Our guest, here's a cliche, a monster one, needs no introduction, so let me introduce him, okay? I could do no better than the first sentence of Tony's Wikipedia entrance, because it says it all in one sentence. Tony Luke Jr., an American restaurateur, entrepreneur, actor, TV host, screenwriter, songwriter, sports reporter, and the founder of the legendary cheesesteak franchise, Tony Luke. Though all those things are eminently true about our guest, Tony Luke Jr., but that is not why Tony is with us today. Tony has just recently this year lost his son, Tony the Third, 35 years of age, to the disease of addiction. And it's been a rough, rough road for the Luke family, losing this young son. So Tony's here to talk about the impact of that and what he has done in the wake of his son's death. Tony Luke Jr., thanks for joining us on Recovery Radio.
Well, thanks for having me, Steve. I appreciate it very much.
You know, I saw the news about your son, and I read the Philly magazine piece, which was terrific. I was struck by the particularly cruel irony of the fact that your son dies of this disease, like millions of people are every day. And as it turns out, his birth over three decades ago was one of maybe the principal reason you managed to control your demons regarding drugs and alcohol, correct?
My soon-to-be wife, excuse me, Franny, was dealing with my addiction and my drug abuse, and she basically said to me, if you don't stop, we're not going to get married, and we're not going to have a family. And I had a horrific night one night. I want to say the word overdose, but there's a difference between overdosing then in my situation than overdosing now. I had mixed a tremendous amount of drugs and alcohol, and my body had a horrific reaction to it. I was taken to the hospital. They didn't have to revive me, but everything was going in a very bad direction. And the doctors gave me something, kind of quelled everything a little bit. And then I was literally high for days after that. I had to stay in a very dark room for my body to recover. And I was, you know, almost 18 years old at the time. And, you know, she basically said to me, you have a choice. You can continue to do what you're doing, or we can get married and start a family, and you can change your life. And I wanted to get married, and I wanted a family. And, you know, I made that choice, but it's unfair sometimes when I tell the story, because I wasn't addicted to heroin, and I wasn't addicted to opioids. I was addicted to crystal meth. Now, methamphetamines is a different type of drug. It's, you know, and I was addicted because of why most people, I believe, get addicted, because there's a crack. There was a crack in me. There was a mental issue that I was dealing with, and mine was a horrific insecurity, and, you know, I was very introverted, and I hated myself, and I hated what I looked like, and I hated being alive, and the drugs kind of made me escape from that. But what saved me was that night where I thought everything was over, that I was dead. That night and the weeks following that, I realized that that person that the drug turned me into, this, and for me it was this happy, this thinner, this, you know, very extroverted individual, you know, people loved and I talked, I realized that that was me all along. It's the drug, I assumed it was the drug that turned me into that. And it wasn't. It was the drug that gave me the confidence to be who I was. And when I realized that, I realized that I didn't need the meth. I didn't need the alcohol. I didn't need those things to be who I thought I wasn't, someone that I wanted to be. And basically, it filled that crack. I recognized the issue that I was dealing with mentally, and I recognized it, and I worked to fix it, which took the need away from me to continue to do the meth and the amphetamines and the alcohol. So I got off, and I never relapsed. And this happened in 1980. It is now 2017, and I've never relapsed into that. And I believe the reason I didn't relapse is because the reason why I was getting high, what I was running away from, what I was trying to kill that I didn't like about myself, I figured out what it was, and I was lucky to have done that. Mm-hmm. I figured out why I was doing that, and I fought and worked at correcting that mental condition of mine that caused me to start getting high in the first place, which eliminated my need to get high. So it wasn't like I stopped and then trained myself to abstain, trained to build the willpower not to do the drug, because I believe that if that was what I was doing, that eventually things would have happened in my life that I would have created a perfect storm and would have relapsed.
Yeah.
I didn't relapse because the drug was not the problem. The mental issue was the problem. The drug, to me, was the solution to fix or run away from that mental issue that I was dealing with. But once the mental issue was fixed, the drug no longer had a place in my life because I didn't suffer with the condition that caused me to do the drugs in the first
place. Yeah, well, you are extraordinarily lucky, as you know, that to have gotten to that point, which is the goal of anybody in treatment for this disease, and that is to get to the root cause, understand that you have a sort of an allergic reaction to this self-medication, work on the problems that are causing that, and as you just correctly pointed out, the drugs and alcohol should fall away as long as you're working on the real problem. What was the reaction of your family? You say these problems for you began in the 80s. We have a different appreciation of addiction today than we did then. It must have been very difficult for an Italian-American family from downtown. How much denial and hiding was going on in your family in those days?
Well, my addiction started in 74, 75. And, you know, I hid it. You know, my family had no idea what I was doing. You know, they were unfamiliar with how drugs worked. What they were incredibly familiar with was how alcohol worked. You know, they knew a little bit about marijuana, but they knew nothing about crystal meth. They knew nothing about Black Beauties and Dizoxins and Quaaludes and Tuminals. You know, none of those things, you know, they knew. They had no idea what they were. So they didn't know what to look for. You know, it was, you know, then it was just alcohol or heroin or LSD. So they knew if someone was tripping, they knew, oh, yeah, these they're taking acid. If they saw a kid on the corner that was trying to stand up and just kept falling down, and he was very, very thin and had track marks, they knew, oh, that's, you know, someone that's using heroin. But meth and, you know, Quaaludes and those kind of drugs, they had no clue what to look for. There was no flag that they looked at and said, oh, I know what this is. So I hid it very well up until the day that, you know, I almost bought the farm and was done, you know, and I had to come clean. And I got to be honest, I really didn't even come clean then. I knew that my father would have basically beat me to death. So I got very lucky where the doctor who treated me basically lied to my father and said that I had a very bad reaction to marijuana, because my father in the hospital was about to get arrested because he was looking to beat up anyone. And the doctor was smart enough to know that if he told him exactly what happened, that he would have killed me. Or at least that would have been his, I'm not saying he would have, but it would have been very, very bad. So, you know, it was, the stigma, you know, started back then. And the stigma was, if you were an addict, which they called back in the 70s, they were called junkies, which I have to tell you, even then to me, and now even more, is one of the most offensive words I have ever heard. When I hear someone use the term junkie, I want to immediately get up and go, do you have any idea what you're saying? Do you know what the word junkie, you know, symbolizes? Do you have any idea? You know, if you want to talk to someone who's addicted, who's fighting addiction, that's one thing. The word junkie is every negative stereo connotation that is connected with someone who is struggling with addiction.
Yeah,
word junkie to me is incredibly offensive, and I don't ever, anyone in my presence that uses that word, I am extremely quick to get up and try to explain to them how horrific that word is and how detrimental it is to someone who is suffering with addiction.
Tony Luke Jr. is our, Tony, I'm going to cut you. We don't get too far behind in the break here. Tony Luke Jr. is our guest. He's here discussing the impact of substance abuse in his life personally, how he managed to control his demons and then tragically watched his son fall victim to the same disease. Tony Luke Jr., our guest on Recovery Radio. We have more with Tony straight ahead. Stay with us. This is Recovery Radio. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Our guest on the telephone is a Philadelphian, legendary Philadelphian restaurateur, actor, writer, and now activist, Tony Luke Jr. Tony, before we took the break there, you were describing your situation as a child of the 60s and 70s, getting all kinds of messed up pills and marijuana and alcohol, landing in the hospital. And because of, a multitude of reasons, the moment that this happens, the background you come from, everybody, including the physician handling you in the hospital, engages in what I call this conspiracy of silence about what was really going on for you. Is that an accurate description of the situation?
Yeah, you know, it's very accurate. But the saddest thing in the world is that was 40, you know, almost 40 years ago, and nothing has changed. In fact, the silence is even worse. So I struggle to understand how a problem can grow exponentially, you know, a thousandfold, yet the hiding and the whispering and the shame and the blame continues in the same course that it did 40 years ago. So the drug epidemic has increased staggering amounts, yet the understanding of it, the willingness to speak about it, the willingness to talk about it openly, hasn't changed in 40 years.
Yeah, this is an interesting disease, and that's, of course, what it is, about which people have attitudes. And that's fascinating, because if I told you I had diabetes, you wouldn't hold it against me. You'd think, oh, he's got diabetes. Or if, God forbid, somebody says they have cancer, you don't say, well, it's your fault. But there is still that sense that you're somehow culpable in this disease. So, you know, again, you got to that peak moment. You saw what the problem was. You worked on it, and you have had a successful escape from this disease. Tell me about your son.
You know, it's when the Philadelphia Magazine article, when Philadelphia Magazine approached me to do the article about Tony and about his death, I was very hesitant to do it. And there were a couple reasons why I was hesitant. You know, this didn't just affect me. It affected my ex-wife. It affected my other two children. It affected Tony's children, my son Michael's children. It affected my parents, my grandparents. So when I was asked to do this, I was very hesitant because that old stereotype and stigma of, well, I don't want to embarrass anyone. I don't want to shame anyone. I don't want to put my story out there. And I struggled with that in the very beginning. And I was like, nah, I don't think I want to do this. You know, my son just passed away. You know, it's only been a couple weeks. We're still grieving, and I don't really want to talk about it. And I fought it. And then a gentleman came to me at my Sicklerville store, which is where I am all the time. And he walked in and he said, Tony, I'm very sorry I heard about your son. And I said, well, I really appreciate that. And he was an elderly gentleman. I'd say he was in his 60s, maybe late 60s, maybe even early 70s. And he said, I'm so sorry. He said, do you mind if I ask you how he died? Was it cancer? And I said, no, he died of a heroin overdose. And he went, damn it. See what these kids do? They ruin their own lives, and then they ruin the lives of the people that love them, and they destroy everything around them. He had his whole future ahead of him, and then he dies of an overdose. And now, I didn't get mad at him, because for some reason, I understood why someone of his age would say that to me. And I thought to myself, wow, my son, who I've never seen work harder to beat this, who was an amazing, loving father to his children, who got up and worked every day, never missing a day's work, who struggled and cried and said to me, Daddy, help me, please, I can't, help me, help me. And he went and he cried, I hate myself, Dad, I hate what I am, I hate. And I'm thinking, my son judged himself every single second of his life, and here's a man that doesn't even know him that's judging him harsher than I judged him. And I knew my son, and I was my son's father, and I remember, you know, calling up and going, you know what, well, you know, we're going to do this magazine, I'm going to lay it all out. And I got a ton of flack because the gentleman that wrote the article was this amazing man who lost his wife to cancer, who was very sympathetic, and he said, Tony, no one just gets hooked. There's reasons. There's mental reasons why. And I said, I totally agree with that. So when he wrote that article, he went back as far as my grandfather and then my father and asked me. And you know what? I didn't hide a damn thing. I told the truth about everything. I told the truth about my grandfather, who was abusive alcoholic, and my father, who was beaten almost every day, and my grandmother, who was beaten by him. And my father developed this very cold, you know, almost non-loving vibe. He would give you things and do things for you, but he would never tell you he loved you, and he was very cold in some things. And that affected the way I was raised and affected the way I looked at myself and relationships. And my son, who was raised with a father who was on TV and was bigger than life, and all my son wanted was his own identity, but he was never, every time he introduced himself, he said, hey, I'm Tony Luther III. Oh, your dad, I know your dad. Your dad, your dad, your dad. Never having an identity and fighting for an identity and dealing what it's like to be a son of someone who throws a giant shadow in his life. And I told the truth, and my father and brother hated me for it and tried, you know, destroyed me on social media. And all I said was, hey, guys, you don't want people to know your business. Everything needs to be a secret. That's why my son is dead, because everything is a secret. There are no more secrets with me. I don't hide a damn thing, and I tell it exactly the way it happened and the way it is. And if you're offended by it, then sorry. I don't know what to tell you. But I don't want anybody else dying or families getting the phone call, because we like to hide and lie and cover everything up. Those days of covering up for me are over. And I did it. And then the story came out, and many people were affected by it. And obviously everyone that was in a bad light was saying that I'm a liar, and it's because that's the mentality. Hey, I don't want people to know my business, so you're a liar. I don't want people to know. And people were affected by that story. A lot of people were helped and opened up by that story. And then when Fox 29 asked me to come on to talk about the article, I said, no, I don't want it. I want to talk about hashtag brown and white.
Are you, Tony, I want to stop you there so we can pick up on that straight ahead. Tony Luke Jr. With us on Recovery Radio, telling us how he has come to grips with, as best one can, the death of his 35-year-old son, a victim of drug and alcohol abuse. This is Recovery Radio. We have more with Tony Luke Jr. straight ahead. Please don't go away. Welcome back. This is Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano. We're here on Saturdays. We talk about the disease of addiction. The whole thing is sponsored by the good people at Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. I want to give you their phone number in the spirit. I give it to you every week. This is an informational number. If they have the treatments that you need, then you could be in no better hands. But if you're calling just for information, they're there for that as well. So I give you the number and hope you never have to use it. 855-859-8808. That's how you reach them. Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, 855-859-8808. Tony Luke Jr. is no stranger to Philadelphians. He has been on television. He has been in the movies. He's a writer. And, of course, he is the founder of the legendary cheesesteak empire, Tony Luke. Tony Luke's 35-year-old son. You must see in him the things you saw in yourself as you struggle with them. How often did you and he talk about? I know he came to you. He knew he was messing up. How often did those conversations take place?
Quite a bit, and I wish that I could sit here and tell you that I understood him, that I said all the right things, and that I was there when he needed me. I wish I could say that, but if I did, it would be 100% of a lie. I loved him. I had no idea what to do. As a parent, I was completely frustrated. I screamed, I yelled, I did the cliche, why can't you just stop? I don't understand. You have children, you have a family that loves you. Just stop doing what you're doing. Why is it that you can't stop? You went to rehab, you came out, you were clean, you used again. You went to rehab, you came back clean again, you used again. I don't understand. What's the problem? Why can't you stop? Dad, I'm trying. Well, you need to try harder. That's the truth, okay? And it destroyed me. And when I didn't know what to do, I resorted to what every parent does, is we get angry, and I'm mad at him. And I'm like, well, I'm mad at you because you're the one that's doing this, and why can't you stop this? Because you know why? Because no one talked to me. Because parents don't speak whose children are struggling. Because maybe, just maybe, if parents weren't ashamed and parents spoke to each other and say, hey, man, my daughter's struggling too. My son is struggling too. What's going on, Tony? Well, I just told him. Why can't he stop? Tony, that doesn't work. I did that. I was like that. But I met this person. You need to look at it from this angle. You didn't look at it this way. You didn't. No, no one told me. So when a parent is frustrated, they make stupid decisions, and it's like, well, if you do it again, then I don't want you inside my home. Because that is the classic way that we treat people struggling with addiction in this country. This is how we treat them as family members. We don't know what to do. We think tough love. Everyone tells them they need to hit rock bottom. Let them hit rock bottom. Well, I'm here to tell you that sometimes rock bottom means 6 feet underground. Do I believe in tough love? Here's how I believe in tough love. Here's what I've learned. You know, my son tried to get me to go to the church with him to meet his pastor. Dad, we're doing things. Tony, I'm working. I'm with you. I support you, but I can't. You know, what am I going to do? Let me try. Tony, I'll try to get there, Tony. I know, but you got to work on Sunday, Tony. Yeah, but Dad, I need to get to this church. What do you mean? You got to pay your bills. What's more important, going to the church or paying your bills? You got to pay your bills. I struggled as a kid. You pay your bills. Never realizing that that Sunday is saving his life. Who cares about the damn work that he's got to do on Sunday? None of those things I knew. And I remember, and everything that I did, that I know that I did incorrectly, that I didn't hear what he had to say to me. When he died, everything came in crystal clear. And you know what? You know the old saying, too little, too late, Tony. So I had to live with that. And I remember speaking 2 days ago, I spoke, and I remember before I got up, I always cry before I speak because I think of him, and I'm sorry, and I said to him how sorry I was that I never saw it, and that I didn't hear him the way I should have heard him, and all I said to him was that I promised him that until the day that I die, I will go everywhere and speak to anyone that will listen. And I will speak 1,000 times a day if I have to, until I drop dead, to make parents understand that that's not the way to do it, that they need love and support constantly, that they need to know that you love them, whether they're using or they're not using, and that this is a horrible disease that works into the mind, and that who you're mad at is not the person you love. It's that horrible monster of addiction that takes over them, that is very one-sided and tunnel vision. All addiction wants is to feed. It's all it wants to do. It doesn't matter who it runs over. It doesn't matter who it tramples on. It just wants to feed. It will lie. It will steal. It will manipulate. But that's not your loved one. That is that disease. That is that addiction that is destroying them. And parents need to understand that. Now, they don't need. If I could do this over again, I would have told Tony, I'm not giving you a dollar, not a penny. You need shoes? I'll get them for you. You need to eat? I have food right here. You need to take a shower? It's here. You want me to be with you? I'm with you. Do you want me to go to meetings with you? I will. Do you want me to take the time that is needed to know that you're loved and your support? And you want to know something, Tony? If you fall, I'll pick you up. If you fall 1,000 times, I'll pick you up. There's no limit to my love. There's no limit. There's no ending to the support that I will give you. And I pray every day that one day, when I pick you up, that miracle happens, and you find out why you're doing what you're doing, and you work on fixing that, and you get your life together again. But you need to know I'm here with you, because you're not a loser, and you're not weak, because that's what he hears. Everyone tells him. He came to me and said, Dad, I'm weak. I'm a loser. I can't beat this. I'm like, no, Tony, you're not. We can beat this. At the end, I started to get it a little bit. We can do this, Tony. I'm going to help you. We're going to get through this. We're going to go. And then I thought, my son is fighting two battles at the same time. He's fighting the addiction, which is so incredibly strong. If you have not gone through addiction, if you don't suffer from addiction, then you don't understand what I'm saying when I say to you it is the most difficult thing in the world that you will ever have to deal with. And besides that, he is dealing with something that I believe is not only just as horrible, but sometimes even more deadly than the addiction itself, is the stigma that is attached to this, that when he walks down the street and people look at him like he's a loser and family members don't want him in his house and they look at him and say, why can't you just stop? You're weak. Anybody with strength could do it. I don't know who you are. And then he believes this weakness, and the addiction loves the fact. Addiction loves that he's feeding into that, that he's feeding into that stigma. They love it because now the addiction grows even stronger. And the addiction whispers in your ear, you are no good, Tony. Your life isn't worth anything. Your family members don't love you. Look at the people on the street. They don't care about you. You know who cares about you, Tony? I care about you. I'm always here for you, Tony. I don't judge you, Tony. I get you high. I get you to forget all the bull that's going on. And then pretty soon, you hate yourself so much that you just sit to yourself and you go, you know what? I just can't wait to die. You know what? I can't wait till the day comes that I overdose. Because I'm living in a damn street.
Tony, do you think...
No one loves me. No one cares about me. That's what they're fighting.
First of all, a couple things. Of all the things that haven't changed with regard to this disease, your reaction as a parent, you know, I've heard this story a million times. Parents are almost the wrong people to try to solve this problem because they have so many counter forces going on. Everything they do seems to be wrong. So that needs to change. That's why your initiative, your brown and white initiative is very important. And the other thing is my question is, do you think your son wanted to die or do you think it was an accident?
No, I know for a fact he didn't want to die because the night before, with all the trouble that went on between me and my family, you know, which I don't want to get into, the night before I had asked my partner to, you know, we took over the Sicklerville store and I brought Tony with me. And I said to him, Tony, he was losing his home. He was losing everything. And he said to me, Dad, I've been going to church every day. I don't know if I'm going to beat it. I said, you are, Tony. I'm with you every step of the way because I was just getting it. I'm with you every step of the way, Tony. I'm here. You're going to work with me every day. We're going to get some money back. We're going to put your life back together again. He goes, I love my daughters. I just want to make it up to them for all I did. I want to make it up to my fiance. You know, I love them, Dad. I love you. I love Mom. I said, I got it. We're going to be okay. And he worked that whole week that we opened, the first week we opened. He worked every day and he was in pain. I saw he was in pain. He said, Dad, my back, I can't, you know, I'm having trouble because he was in a bad, very bad car accident. So he always had a bad back and he can't take medication for it. He can only take Motrin or Tylenol. And he's like, my back, I can't. And I said, no, Dad, you're going to be all right. And Sunday night, he looked at me, and I hugged him. And I said, go home, Tony. You're dead tired. I said, you're off tomorrow. We open again on Tuesday. And I said, Tony, we got this. He goes, Dad, we got this, Dad. I'm telling you, Tony, we're going to make it. You're going to make it. We're going to put our life back together again. We're going to put our family back together again. We're going to make this work. And he kissed me. And he told me that he loved me, and he walked out that door. And then the next morning at 8:30, I got up early. I was going to call him and tell him how proud I was and how hard he was working. And I just wanted to tell him again that we were going to get through this, that it was going to work, and that there was hope, Tony, there's hope. And then I thought, you know what? He worked all night that night. He was dead tired. Let me let him sleep. And then I had an event to do at Citizens Bank Park, and then, you know, the day gets away from you, and I said, you know what, he's off today, I'll talk to him tomorrow, I'll call him tonight when I'm done the event. And I was at Citizens Bank Park, and I was kind of in a basement area. They were doing a show, showing everyone all the new food for the ballpark for that season, and this was on March 27th. And I didn't have much of a reception, and my phone rings, and it's about 6 o'clock, and I see my son Michael's name come up. And normally, I'm working. I figured I'll call him back, but for some reason, I answered it. And I had a bad reception, and I was hearing every other word, and all I heard was him crying, going, Dad, dead, dad, dead, dead. I don't know who died.
now I'm panicking and he's crying. You know, did his mom die? Did someone in my family die? Who died? You know, who could have died? And I run up the steps to go out because to get reception, I fall. The phone falls out of my hand, falls down the steps. I run back down to grab the phone. I run back upstairs, out the doors. I don't know where I am. I'm just outside of Citizens Bank Park. And now I have reception. I go, Michael, Mike, can you hear me? He's like, yeah, Dad. I'm like, what happened? And I will, till the day I die, I will hear his voice. And he said, Stacy called. That's Tony's fiance. Stacy called. Tony's dead.
I got to stop you there, Tony. Tony, I got to stop you there because we're gonna back up here. I want to get some information about Brown and White straight ahead. Tony Lucas sharing the story of his son's death with us, and his struggle to come to grips with that, and the work he's doing to make sure other people understand what's at stake with the disease of addiction. Recovery Radio, stay with us. We're back on Recovery Radio. I want to thank our guest Tony Luke Jr., who is literally in the initial stages of all of the grief and heartache that comes when you lose a loved one to the disease of addiction. His son, Tony, passed away at the age of 35 just this past March. And Tony's dealing with all of that, as you might imagine, the horror of that, and has dedicated himself to taking the platform he has as a noted person in the area to advance this cause of bringing awareness and destigmatizing the disease of addiction. Tell us, and we got a couple of minutes left, Tone. Tell us about the Brown and White Initiative.
Hashtag Brown and White is a social media campaign that was started by me and a group of friends. And social media is a very large platform. What we wanted to do to break this stigma, we asked all those who have lost a loved one to this addiction to post a picture of their loved one on social media with their loved one's name and a little bit about who they were using the hashtag Brown and White. And it's Brown and it's A-N-D-W-H-I-T-E. So it's the words Brown and White, hashtag Brown and White, to let the world know that they are not ashamed, that their loved one was not to blame, that they weren't weak and they weren't losers, that they were human beings who loved and struggled and died losing this fight to addiction, to get families talking. We asked recovery centers, use the word hashtag Brown and White in everything that you do. So people, families who don't know what to do, can go on Facebook, put in the hashtag, go on Twitter, put in the hashtag, and all of this wealth of information will come up. Families can connect and talk to each other. And then I want the government and people, the lawmakers and insurance companies, to stop talking about statistics. My son was not a statistic. Your loved one was not a statistic. They were a human being. And so I want faces and names to be attached to their numbers so they know that they are not a number. And that, believe me, things will change when people look and they go, oh my God, my next door neighbor just put up a picture of his son or his daughter or his father or brother or sister. And I didn't know that they were struggling. We're struggling too. Let's go talk to them. I want people to know that those are not numbers, that they're faces and they're human beings. And I ask everyone, I beg of them, wear a bracelet of Brown and White. Wear a shirt that's Brown and White. Wear a ribbon, a Brown and White ribbon wrapped around each other. Show solidarity and let people struggling with addiction know that they are loved not just by their family, that they are loved by all those who support them and want to help get them the recovery and the support that they need. So it's important. So please, anyone listening to this radio show, I know you hear what I'm saying, but listening to me doesn't help the cause. I don't make a penny from this. We don't take no donations. It's not a charity. It's not a foundation. I don't sell anything. I get nothing from this. I need everyone that's listening, please use the hashtag Brown and White in all your social media. Talk about your loved one. Put a picture. Let people know where they can go and get help. use that hashtag. Let this thing go global and let these people with addiction, all of these loved ones, know that they are not alone.
Tony, thanks for sharing the story with us. Good luck. Our condolences again. And everybody remember, hashtag brown and white. Take care. Enjoy your weekend and look for Recovery Radio next Saturday.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.